Now, folks, back in October, while sitting in for Noel McGuinness on Northside Today, I interviewed a man called Ray Taylor. Ray wrote a book called Mr. Ray, Would You Like a Monkey? And it tells the stories of his time as a humanitarian and aid worker in Bosnia, Croatia and Africa. And I'm glad to say that he's on the line now from his home in Skerries. Ray, good morning to you.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm very well. And how are you this morning?
Oh, okay, yes. Good weather. Nice morning.
Indeed it is. Now, we got in touch with you because of what's happening in Ukraine. Because you yourself have been to places where, as you say in your book, where the wars were, and also you were in Africa during the wars. Now, I have to tell you, Ray, straight away, that, and you'll understand what I meant when I was talking to you yesterday. I was thinking of you during the week when I saw the footage of Sky News reporter Stuart Ramsay and his crew coming under fire. And it reminded me of a piece in your book. Did you actually see that clip of film, news film, Ray?
No, I didn't, but I can imagine what it was like.
It was unbelievable. There was about five of them in the car. And I'm not sure where they were going. They were in Ukraine, and I'm not sure where they were going. But they came under fire. Now, some say it was probably the Russian soldiers, and others say it might have been Ukraine soldiers thinking that they weren't who they said they were. Anyway, it lasted for about 5 minutes, and how nobody was killed is unbelievable. You hear and see the bullets coming into the car. Anyway, if you can get it on YouTube there. But anyway, right. As I said to you, it reminded me of a piece in your book before you went to Africa, when you were briefed on security and what to do when under fire. And the lecturer, he summed it up all by saying to you, if you see Kate 80, run like hell. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember that. I remember
yeah.
Very well.
Yeah. So, in other words, wherever Kate goes, you don't go. So, God help if any future people going out to help out now, I suppose Kate 80 will be... she will be now put into second place, and if you see Stuart Ramsay, don't go anywhere where he's gone. Anyway, you've been to Bosnia, Croatia after the wars, and then you went to Kenya, South Sudan, Sierra Leone during the war. So, as an aid worker, how do you go about organising help for refugees?
Okay, well, what we look basically is what the basic needs are, and the basic needs for people who have fled their homes due to war are the same no matter where the conflict is. And those needs are water, food, shelter, sanitation, health support, security, and possibly transport.
Mm-hmm.
We recognise that the most vulnerable are the old and the very young. And these are sort of clearly identified in the process. Older people can have health issues such as heart problems or diabetes, you know, blood pressure that needs controlling, and the very young don't have the resilience of teenagers or adults in their prime.
Mm-hmm.
So if the pharmacies, for example, have been destroyed or the pharmacists have fled, then
yeah,
the health of the sick and elderly, they can go downhill very, very fast. So how do we address it? Well, just to be brief on that, we address the needs in their entirety or as a group of needs, rather than on a piecemeal approach. So, for example, food is as important as water,
mm-hmm,
but without shelter, in the present conditions, they
yeah
can become ill, freeze to death, you know, depending on the location. If there, I mentioned sanitation there. Lack of sanitation will cause disease.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the first time I went on a training course, I was given this list of basic needs, along with a lot of other people, and they said, right, write these down in order of priority. And I pondered and I moved things around, and you needed water, this happened, and so on. And we all worked very hard at it to get the right answer. And when we were told, right, your 5 minutes is up, they said, right, what do you have? And I read out my list, and other people read out theirs, but they said, right, well, you're all wrong. that all those needs have priority. You can't put one above the other.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of brought it home to me. So as I say, we address it, the needs in their entirety.
Yeah.
Food is as important as water. Without shelter, as I said, they'll freeze. They may need to be dispersed to different locations depending on the numbers, and this is what we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment, or coming out of Ukraine, I should say,
mm-hmm.
into various places. So transport, a lot of transport may be needed.
Yeah.
To achieve all these things, what do you need? You need trained people, good logistics, and lots of local support. To summarise, I suppose, the answer would be war disrupts the normal services, so we have to step in and provide the essential ones.
Yeah, and is there a recognised procedure or process for dealing with the situation? Like, you've got thousands of refugees pouring into the neighbouring countries.
Yes. Well, there is a recognised procedure or process for dealing with the situation, but the process has to be flexible because all these things can be different from time to time. But yet the same basic needs are there, as I said. For instance, in the early stages of an emergency, some of those fleeing will have a plan that could involve staying with relatives or friends. So they'll only need short-term support. And we've seen that on the television, people coming in saying, I'm going on to relatives in Germany, I'm going on here, I'm going on there. So they just need the short-term support. Others, however, may have fled with the only plan being to get away from the danger.
Yeah.
And they'll need a lot more support based on their needs. So the process has to accommodate both situations and everything in between. So how do we do it? Well, long-term people will be registered as refugees. And in this way, the number of people involved is known.
Yeah.
So you might say, well, how important is that? Well, it's very important because you can't arrange supplies accurately. You can't, say you need blankets. How many blankets do you need for how many people? You can't arrange supplies accurately without knowing the number of people who need them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know it's a constant changing situation, but we sort of add in factors to cover that. In the same way, people with health issues need to be identified so that they can get adequate health support. As I said, particularly the older people.
Mm-hmm.
All of this takes time. So in the early days, there's a huge workload and people are needed who've been trained to deal with this. But they also need the help of local volunteers. And a lot of local people start to get, they get brought in for their local knowledge. There's mm-hmm. no use of me going, say, to such and such a place, I want to be a driver. I wouldn't know where the heck I would go.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And so you use the local knowledge, well.
Yeah, and tell me this, with the amount of people you have to deal with, how is all the work involved? How is it shared out and who decides who does what and where?
Yeah, well, this is the big question. How do you organise or put order on chaos, which is what it tends to look like in the very beginning? And it does be chaotic, it definitely is. But there's always a lead organisation appointed, an organisation who's in overall charge.
Mm-hmm.
So, who coordinates the different NGOs providing help. And they allocate different tasks and locations as well, keeping in mind any specialist skills that the NGOs may have. But just to give you some examples, Oxfam are excellent at providing emergency water supplies.
Right.
I've used them in various places where they're, I need water supplies into a camp, and Oxfam come up and they install, they have all these kits where we'd be sort of playing around with it for days. Médecins Sans Frontières, the health org provide health.
Mm-hmm.
Concern in Dublin have experience in emergency shelter and food supplies as well as health.
Mm-hmm.
So they try and sort of target the different NGOs for their expertise. The lead organisation that in charge is usually the UN, or it could be what we call ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is a conglomeration of all the different Red Crosses around the world.
Yeah.
UNHCR, that's the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, as the name suggests.
Mm-hmm.
They're the specialist UN agents for dealing with refugees, so they will more than likely be in charge of the whole operation there. Now, I worked with them in Kenya and Somalia, and this is an interesting thing, sort of, for your listeners might wonder where is all this stuff going to come from.
Yeah.
But the UNHCR, they have access to large stocks of various supplies stored in different parts of the world, just put by for what we're seeing now. You hope you never need them,
yep.
But they're there when you want them. So And supplies would include such things as blankets, tarpaulins, tents, kitchen utensils, plastic sheeting, flat pack construction kits for shelter for actually building rooms, and jerry cans. I just mentioned about the jerry cans. The jerry cans are collapsible plastic jerry cans, so you can fit lots of them into a container for delivery. But that's just a few of the things that are in storage.
Yeah.
But just to expand on the storage business, I spent some time trading with UNHCR in Italy, where some of the massive storage units are located.
Yeah.
And in the midst of all these thousands and thousands of items, I was happy to see large quantities of blankets, which had a big notice on them, supplied by the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs. So, you know, Ireland makes a huge contribution into this. But also the location of the storage units was very well thought out, because they were at an Italian military base, for Air Force and Naval base.
Yeah.
And so that the goods could be placed directly onto transport. It didn't have to be transported and then offloaded and transported again. They could be placed directly on whether it was a plane or a ship, because it was a military and a naval base.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's all part.
That's all part. And I suppose the other side of that is where you seem to, from what I'm saying there, it's handy that the stuff is near the airport or it's near the port. And then the work comes in trying to get it to where you want to when it arrives at your, you know, when it arrives in Africa or wherever. There must be a lot of work trying to get it out to the people then that need it.
Oh, there is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Massive work. Well, can
it's a massive operation.
Yeah. Can I ask you, as you say, you've been there, you've done all this work. So how do you cope with the huge numbers of refugees involved? And give us an example of how you dealt with large numbers from your previous experience, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. I sort of prefaced that by saying when I first went on training courses and they said, how do you do this? I really felt a bit overwhelmed on the training course. I thought, that must be impossible to achieve. But then they showed us how to do it. And so how we go about it is, as I said earlier on, very early on we register the refugees, that we have the numbers of adults and children involved and the age profile. Ration books or registration documents are then issued. So it's a record in the system of those registered. But as everybody can see at the moment, it's a fluid situation where the numbers are constantly changing. So we use the figures that we have at any one time and then add the percentage to estimate what the figures will be for the next week or month. And these figures are constantly updated. This gives us something to work with, so as we need data to get the grips of planning. Data is a much used word at the moment.
Yes.
But we do need it for planning. And it would be very easy to be overwhelmed with the numbers unless you have a plan that is flexible. Now, in order for us to cope with the huge task, we use what is called someone nicknamed it the elephant theory. Our question is, how do you eat an elephant?
Right.
And the answer is piece by piece. You asked there about an example, and I hope I don't confuse people with figures here. But a very good example was the Civil War in Darfur, where we were tasked with providing food for 240,000 people. Okay, so the first task was to get the food, but that was easily solved. The United Nations World Food Programme had large quantities in stock, and they were able to supply it. So we estimated the total quantity. How I went about it, I estimated the total quantity for 3 months' rations, based on the information that we had, and advised the UN what I needed. They delivered it to me. Now, a ration consisted of 14 days food supply per person. So that was basically stuff like porridge. But anyway, so those 240,000 rations had to be delivered twice a month. If you get hand out 14 days supply, you have to deliver twice a month. But they weren't all delivered in the same day. That would have been impossible. And this is where the elephant theory comes in.
Okay.
The solution was to deliver the food over 10 separate days, a 10-day cycle. So that each day, instead of giving 240,000, because there was a tent, we delivered 1,000 rations on any given day.
Right.
So they sent 240,000. So we arranged at each distribution point, one person would collect the rations for four people, which meant that the 24,000 rations would need 6,000 people, if you divide by four, 6,000 people to collect the food. So, if you're still with me...
I'm still with you.
Okay, this is a bit like sort of pyramid selling in reverse. If we issued the food, in, keeping in mind now 6,000 people needed to collect a day's supplies, if we issued the food, though, in three different locations on that day, now we only have to deal with 2,000 people.
Right.
Okay?
Yes.
So, at any given location. Now, 2,000 people was manageable, but it was very, very hard work.
Yeah.
And on a non-stop cycle of 10 days. So, of the remaining 4 days then, and this is all part of the planning, of the remaining 4 days left out of the 14, before the next cycle, we use those to update the... we used those 4 days to update the figures we needed, sort out any issues that had arisen, as well as organise any work that had to be done on the trucks, because they break down. So, as you can see, it was full on.
Yes.
But then, off we go again, distributing over the next 10 days. And the word was, repeat, 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 for months on end.
Yeah.
Now, it was hectic, but to be quite honest, like, I came home at Christmas that year, and I'd lost 30 pounds in over a couple of months, in weight. I was a shadow of my former self, but it was hectic. But as bad as it was for us, the people who were running the health program from Concern, they went to the camps every 7 days, because they weren't dealing with 240,000 people. They were dealing with the sick, which would be a percentage of that.
Yes.
So that was the good news from the point of view, but they were under huge pressure. And the basic answer was, work out a system, and if it works, repeat it.
Stick with it, yeah.
It's logistics. We crunch the numbers and come up with solutions. So I suppose the answer to the question is, it all boils down to reducing the problem into manageable proportions. Or, as I said at the beginning, how do you eat the elephant?
Yeah, I understand, yeah. The one thing that I in your book, again... you had to learn about to recognise different types of gunfire and explosions. What was all that about?
It was about so that you didn't become a liability to yourself and others.
Yeah.
Because if you're working in war zones, these are the sort of things that happen. And my first course I went on was run by an English agency called Red R, which was Registered Engineers for Disaster Relief.
Mm-hmm.
And they organised this training with the British Army. So then I went to Nottingham and sort of was subjected to all this stuff and mock gunfire, but they were fired at length, thank God, and how to get out of minefields.
Yeah.
And then I went on a course with the Irish Defence Forces. They start doing the same thing. And again, it's to recognise the gunfire. Like, there's a huge difference between heavy machine gun fire and rifle fire. But the heavy machine gun bullets, you'll see some of the stuff on the news there where there's holes in the walls of buildings. That's heavy machine gun fire.
Yeah.
They just blow place to bits, you know.
Yeah.
Well, so that's what it was about.
Yeah. I would imagine when you're looking at the news yourself now, to bring it all back to you, how do you feel when you see what's happening?
I feel very sorry to see what's happening, very sad seeing what's happening. It's like deja vu. It's like looking at Bosnia in the 90s. And this same thing, targeting civilians, targeting civilian builds, non-military. It's just the same. It's like we learned nothing from Bosnia. It's the exact same thing all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Very sad.
Very sad. Indeed, yeah.
Terrible for the people that are there.
Yeah.
They'd be traumatised for a long, long time.
Yeah.
You know.
And going back again in your training there, you saw TV coverage that the man and woman at home in their homes wouldn't see. To give you an idea of what you're going to be going into, that must have been. I can't imagine how you felt when you saw what we did. What we weren't seeing.
Yeah, well, it was meant to shock. And it did. But it was also to shock you in such a way that you'd be aware that this is how you can get yourself blown to bits. Just to give you a very simple example. If you have a hand grenade hanging from the handle inside a toilet cistern, and you flush that cistern, it pulls out the pin of the hand grenade.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Well, now, I mean, that's horrible stuff. But
yeah.
That's the sort of thing that happens.
Yeah.
Know? So you need to be aware of it.
Yeah. And of course, if the children went out to play football, don't play on soft ground or grass. Because you could...
Oh, yeah.
There's a mind there.
That stuck with me for a long time. I'll tell you how long that stuck with me for, Joe. I went back after 10 years to Bosnia when the war was long over. I went on holidays. Just, I had this thing I wanted to go back to lay the ghost.
Yes.
And I went on a tour out near the airport, and there was grass area where there had been a tunnel. And this guide said, this is where how we got under the airport. By tunnel, and they walked down, and the woman leading the tour said to me, "You've been here before," and I said, "How do you know that?" And she said, "I know by the way you're walking on the grass. You're still terrified."
Oh, right. Fair play to her. She copped you on. Yes, indeed. The other thing, of course, going back to Kenya and Somalia, you were talking about really improvising. The strange one was taking the doors off the airplane to make it lighter, which didn't go down too well with one or two people on board with you.
Yeah, well, what it was, the airstrip where we were supposed to bring in supplies was flooded. A river burst its banks, so the plane couldn't land. They were just dirt strips, you know, mud strips. And it was the pilot, actually, one of the pilots who I became friendly with. He was a bit crazy. He was in America.
Yeah.
And I said to him, "How are we going to get supplies in?" And he said, "We can't." And then we said, "Look, is there any chance we could do an airdrop like the UN do, you know, the big Hercules planes?" And he said, "Oh, we'll try that." So he actually said, "Give me a hand." So we took the plane, the doors off the back of the plane. They dropped down like bomb doors. You actually walked up a little step into them.
Yeah.
And we flew with them for a short distance. And there was a bit of vibration, but his answer to that, "I'll probably be all right. Let's go." So we loaded up the plane and flew into it. It was nearly a 3-hour flight. I was frozen in it because
yes.
I forgot it. Didn't allow for it being so cold. But we threw out the supplies out the door. We were strapped in those holes. We wouldn't fall out.
But the main thing is you got the supplies in one way or the other.
Yes,
and that's
delivered.
Is there anything you'd like to add to our conversation this morning, Ray? Regarding
First of all, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
Not at all.
and sort of recount some of these experiences.
Yeah. You got a bit of a surprise yesterday when I told you we last spoke in October.
Yeah, I did. I thought it was only about 2 months ago. Yeah. That's what happens when you get old. Time goes quicker.
Yeah. Sorry for interrupting you. Go ahead anyway, what you were saying there.
No. I was going to say, like, people, are shocked at what they see on the television now. The problem is usually if these people see this stuff long enough, they become certainly sort of immune to it over a period of time. And I think just for people to remember, these are families like we have here.
Yeah.
You know, these are husbands, wives, daughters, mothers, fathers, etc., sons. You know, they're people just like us that are being subjected to horrific conditions.
Yeah.
And if you can give to somebody like the Red Cross who are sending out, or whatever, an NGO of your choice, but the Red Cross are certainly leading the charge here in Ireland, I think, at the moment, where, you know, they're trying to organise accommodation for people.
Do you think we're taking it more serious than perhaps we took Syria?
Yes, we are definitely taking it more seriously. Yeah, Syria, I think it's unfortunate, but if it's close by, it's much closer to us.
Yes.
And we're seeing it every day on television. Syria was a complicated setup. I was on the border, actually, in Syria, in Lebanon, which I just throw that in for what it's worth.
Go ahead.
It was that same sort of horrible experience of seeing people traumatized, frightened. There's nothing worse than seeing children frightened. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
Horrific.
Yeah, I know. Like, and I'm guilty of it. You know, we've seen all the pictures from Syria back, and when back a few years ago. But now, when I look at what's happening in Ukraine, and I see the young children, I just think of my grandson and my granddaughter. Yeah. They're the same age, and God, I would hate to see them going through that. You know, it's really, really t- terrible to say it, indeed. I was going to ask you if you would change your hat now and put on your motorbike hat. I saw there yesterday in Racing Ireland's magazine, the front cover, William Dunlop. There was a statue put up in his honour. I think it's in Ballycastle there.
What's that for? Right, okay. Yeah, okay.
Can you hear me?
I can, yeah. I'm not sure where it was put up, but yeah. It put very well to Ballycastle, yeah.
Yeah, his picture was on the front cover of the Racing Ireland's magazine. This month's magazine there. Because as you say, you are you still involved at the road racing?
I am.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, can I ask you this? Sorry, I meant to ask you this. Would you go back out and do what you were doing again? In if you like, God, if the war ended in Ukraine, would you go back out to help, or would you be allowed to go back out?
That's a very good question. I would like to be involved is the first part.
Yeah.
The first thing to say, I would like to be involved. I just feel I want to be in the middle of where the I can do something, you know, rather than at a distance. But of course, you need all the millions of people that give money.
Yes.
And I can be one of them to help.
To help.
Would I go back? I probably. Honest answer is I'm probably too old now. As I explained there, it's full on. Like in the book I mentioned, I work 49 days on the trot, mm-hmm. working 14
yeah.
hours a day
yeah.
for the Sudan. And then after 3 days, I was sort of up firing on all cylinders again
yeah.
because of the adrenaline. But I'm in my 70s now, and I don't have the stamina for that sort of pace. If I was asked to get involved here and give advice or sort of do some of the logistics, I would certainly jump at that.
Right.
But I wouldn't be able for the 60, 70-hour weeks anymore, I'm
no,
afraid.
No, I can understand that.
I wish I could.
You wish
I
you wish could. I could. Wouldn't we all.
Yeah,
wouldn't
yeah.
we all. Ray, we're gonna leave it there with you, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
I really enjoyed your book. I have it in my hand here again. And oh, listen, come here. I know we've gone over time, but I'm not going to worry about that. Mr. Ray, would you like a monkey? Explain as quickly as you can how to the listeners how the name came up. Would you like a monkey?
Yeah, I was building schools in Mozambique after the massive floods there. The infrastructure was in tatters. And we had weekly meetings, and I was living out in the bush with this team of local guys, engineers and workers. And anyway, I had an interpreter, and each week we had a meeting planning what was to be done. And there was a screeching noise outside the house, and I said to the interpreter, that sounded like a monkey. And he obviously misheard me with everybody else chatting away and said, oh, you'd like a monkey. And I said, no, it sounds like a monkey. And then around the table I heard Mr. Ray and like a monkey. And I thought it was a joke.
Yes.
And they were just winding me up. And then the next night someone knocked on the little house we were living in. And I said, I wonder who that is. And the interpreter said, that's the monkey. He said, it's like a monkey. I ended up with a monkey.
Very well, something to bring home as a present, I suppose.
Now, I'd love to have brought it home, but I think it would have had problems there, you know.
Yeah, I think so. Ray, look, it's been a pleasure talking to you again, and we wish you all the best. And again, your book is called Mr. Ray, Would You Like a Monkey? Memories from the Frontline of Humanitarian Aid. Ray Taylor, look after yourself. And we may see you out in Skerries there, or what's the other place? It's Skerries Racing.
Killalane.
That's the one.
No, unfortunately, Killalane's gone.
Yeah.
It won't be run anymore, as I understand it. But
that's
it. Come to Skerries, sunny Skerries.
Not a bother. Thanks for taking the call, Ray.
Thank you.
Look after yourself. Take care. Bye bye.